My name is Kathy Graber. I'm the director of the creative writing program at VCU. And I'm just absolutely thrilled to have Nick Flynn here. And I'm thrilled that we've been able to attract such a stellar audience for him tonight. In a somewhat creepy comment in a Rolling Stone interview a few years back, Bob Dylan said about Alicia Keys, and I'm paraphrasing, "There ain't nothing about that girl I don't like." In an effort to be considerably more appropriate, I can say, "There ain't nothing about Nick Flynn's work I don't like." The joy of giving an introduction is that you get to speak for about 2 or 3 minutes regarding your own particular fascination with someone else's project. Hence, if you write a 300-page memoir and you mention the German literary critic Walter Benjamin once, you can expect that if I introduce you, that's where I'm going to start. Nick Flynn quotes Benjamin on the nature of collective memory. "The most extraordinary things, marvelous things, are related with the greatest accuracy, but the psychological connection of events is not forced on the reader. It is left to him to interpret things the way he understands them, and thus the narrative achieves an amplitude information lacks." I feel that this might have been a blurb for The Reenactments, Nick Flynn's third memoir, but I feel it could also have been a blurb for Another Night in Suck City, or a blurb, another bullshit night in Suck City, I'm sorry. Another bullshit night in Suck City, a blurb for My Feelings, or The Captain Asks for a Show of Hands, or any of his 3 memoirs and 4 collections of poems. Elsewhere in The Reenactments, he writes, "The web trembles." Maybe that metaphor is easier to understand than the words of a philosopher. When you touch any thread on the web, the whole web hums. This has become a pretty familiar way to talk about the universe, and it is actually a fairly accurate one in terms of what we know about particles and matter and energy. If each of Nick Flynn's works is a tiny universe, once he has set the principal lines of that microcosm in place, every subsequent step implicates all the others. This is what Benjamin understood about what he called the nonsensical similitude of things. There is nothing that is not related to everything else. This may sound to you either simplistic or grand, but it is quite honestly for me the most essential aspect of this writer's ambition and hence his achievement. In The Reenactments, we are actually given a partial litany of the threads as the writer first perceived them, a triptych, flowers, film, memory. But these things implicate or imply so much more. Neurology, art, history, technology, semblance, resemblance, ritual, even faith. The list goes on. Totemic power of things, the power of the stories we tell ourselves, and ultimately the very nature of metaphor and image, and therefore the nature of poetry, which does not move us beyond or away from the seemingly blank space of dark matter or spiritual emptiness, the unknown, but is the very thing which thrusts us into its vital and necessary engagement. Isaac Babel claimed his grandmother warned him that to be a writer, you must know everything. I would add that you must also know what you cannot know. Nick Flynn's work is, for me, an enactment of the preoccupations that makes Walter Benjamin's work seem so frighteningly prescient now. At the very dawn of the age of photography, he foresaw that this was a medium that would transform the way we engaged with and responded to the world. Flynn's work wrestles mightily not only with the recorded, appropriated, mitigated world that lives in our phones, our tape recorders, our reels of film, our books, our language, but also with the movies and scripts we are shooting, editing, photoshopping, overdubbing, splicing every moment of every day in our minds. And how the film we call history, our brutal and violent history, is being shot and exposed like sheets of vellum over or under or within our own. To the extent that we are writers, directors, the actors, the audiences, as well as the cinematographers of our own inner lives. When your hidden subject is actually the nature of human and animal consciousness and our evolving understanding of time, there is almost nothing that does not seem to matter. As heady as I have made Flynn's ambitions seem, the tone of his work is richly speculative and often conversational. His voice provides a mirror, though sometimes a fractured or distorted one, of the fractured and sometimes provocatively slippery language of our times. The best writers ultimately compose a body of work that is also more than the sum of its parts. Perhaps Flynn is on his way to becoming something like an American Knausgård, the Norwegian writer whose single novel is 3,000 pages long. Though unlike Knausgård, Nick Flynn's achievement is not in the narrowness of his gaze, but rather in the astonishing breadth of its embrace. For his work does indeed possess precisely what Walter Benjamin so praised. It offers us in the scope and ordering of its wonder an amplitude information alone would lack. Please welcome Nick Flynn.
Hi, everybody. Wow, look at everybody in the back. I have this feeling that you guys in the back, you think like you want to be able to escape quickly if it sucks. And I don't blame you. Thank you so much, Kathy. That was really amazing. That was, that was outrageous. I'm not going to read from that book tonight. I'm going to read from a new book called My Feelings. It's a book of poems. Anyone want to comment on the title? I'm going to tell you how I got the title, actually. I was a writing coordinator at a place called the Fine Arts Work Center, which is this artist residency in Provincetown, Massachusetts, which is one of my homes. And 10 visual artists and 10 writers come there for the winter. And I was in charge of coordinating the writers that were going to come. And I was completely unprepared for the job because like 800 people applied with big packets of work. And I had to organize them and Xerox the checks and stuff. And I'm just not good at that. So in the midst of this wading through this pile of manuscripts, one manuscript came in, a manuscript of poetry, and it was called My Feelings. And I was so pissed off by that that I threw the manuscript across the room. And I said, who the fuck would call a book My Feelings? But then I dutifully picked it up at the end of the day, and then I read a few poems and threw it again, and then picked it up and read it again and threw it. But it kept ending up in my desk, and I kept wondering. I could never tell whether the writer was naive or a genius or sincere or ironic or fucking with me, or I had no, I couldn't figure out the stance. So I ended up putting this person forward for a fellowship, but they didn't. They didn't get the fellowship, unfortunately, because the other people, there's a committee, there's like 10 people, and they all had the same initial reaction when they saw it. They threw it across the room. So a dozen years later, here I am, and I've called a book My Feelings, and I did it because out of those 800 manuscripts, the only title I remembered was My Feelings. So I'm hoping someone, the actual author of the title, actually comes up one day and says, you stole my title. I mean, it's not really stealing, just to put that out there. I'm going to do that corny thing that cheesy bands do when they visit a new city. I'm going to read a poem that's based in Virginia. Virginia. And this is my only poem based in Virginia. Someone asked me to write a poem for Monticello. You guys probably all know what Monticello is. Thomas Jefferson's home. I've never been there. I'd never gone to it. I still haven't gone to it. And I didn't know much about it, really. So I did some research. I worked on it for a long time. I couldn't really get it. And then something happened where, I don't even know if I should tell you the story. Maybe not. No, it's too complicated. I just saw these little kids playing a game. These little kids were playing a game, and it sort of like fit into the whole story. It ends with some lines of Thomas Jefferson's all throughout it, and then there's other strange stuff in it. And when I came up with a title, that's what sort of also got me. It so creeped me out, it seemed worthwhile. So it's called When I Was a Girl. When I was a girl, climbing outside my body, every eye I felt, my legs no longer mine. A circle of boys, a circle of girls. Let's play slave, one said. I'll be master, you be yard boss. You can do my whipping for me. If I want the rest to carry me, they will carry me. I will make a moving throne of their bodies. Look here, this one has a good set of teeth. I will call her nursemaid. She will live in my mansion. I will come in the night. Yes, she will say, yes, as I write everything out on her back. When I was a girl, no one kissed outside of a word, but the word couldn't be kiss or lips or tongue. The word had to point to something outside us. An ant, say, carrying a leaf. That was the game. When I was a girl, I'd strap one on. She'd look over her shoulder. I could make her smile. Find me as I'm falling, I'd whisper. Geologists now claim that the ocean is fed by an invisible ocean, a crystal at the center of the earth. It waits, not as vapor, not as liquid, not as ice, but crystal, an enormous jewel waiting to open. So much I don't understand. In the beginning, girls ran across burning fields with swords made of sticks. Girls hid in trees, stones heavy in their hands. In the beginning, I was a girl. I held up my hand and it filled with sunlight. If a bird landed in my palm, I could either crush it or set it free. That's my Virginia poem. That's all I got for you. Don't do that. You should save the applause till the end, like let it build up inside you until it's unbearable. Otherwise, I'll read one, you won't clap, and I'll feel really bad. Or you won't clap as much or something, so it's better just to hold it all inside. Good advice for anything. I want to read this one, too, just to another creepy poem. I teach grad school in Houston to these really great poets, and at the end of the semester, we took a couple of years ago, I had them take all the poems they had written and then sort of just take the really good lines out of them and make new poems out of them. Out of their whole semester of writing, you know, like 14 poems, they took the best lines out of them and made one poem, you know, which might have been depressing if at the end of the semester you only have one poem instead of 14, but that's what we did. So I actually took their poems and then took all of what I thought were their good lines and made my own poem from their good lines, which kind of creeped them out. And here it is. But I have to tell you who wrote it, though. I didn't write any of these lines, so I have to read it so that you don't think I stole them. And it also has a form. It's called a cento, which is a form of taking lines from other places and putting them together. And it comes from Roman warriors in a battle. They would go and collect the armor from different fallen soldiers and put it on. And that's the sort of form. It's called a cento. And this is a cento made up of lines gathered from poems by Josh Gottlieb Miller, Jennifer Lowe, Caitlin Plunkett, Nicole Walker, Michelle Oakes, Allie Rowbottom, and Patrick James. And it's called Homily. Brothers and sisters, the kingdom of heaven is bought and sold. Go ahead, punish me, turn me into salt. It is an act of sanity to walk by the trees. Sometimes when I'm home all day, I try to remember to put up the blinds. Sunlight glances off my skin as if I've stopped on either side of a two-way mirror. While outside, the hills repeat themselves, lions, 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 all of us waiting for the bell to be built in our blood. Brothers, sometimes it seems unkind to keep goldfish in a tank, the body slumped from midday sun, left breathing its thought. My boy thinks they're rainbows. He points and calls them rainbows. He stared at himself too long in the mirror. Pride and satisfaction spread across his face like oil, across his cheeks like war paint. Still, the face of any man is the face of all men. Sisters, sometimes when I'm home all day, I hear what sounds like gunshots, followed by what I can only describe as a strangled moan. Remember the story of the tornado, the horses, framed by the stall window, switch their tails in darkness. Brothers, sisters, I want to thank you for how beautifully your hands move. We make the world in which we live. I strap myself to the breaking wheel. Consider my sin a hymn of praise. Understanding the miracle, I forget what it is. So that was woven together by me. That's all it is, really, you know, poems. It's just like material. You just have to put it in the right order. That probably doesn't help you much if you're a beginning writer. I'm going to read, it's called Cathedral of Salt. There's these cathedrals, like the Monticello poem. It seems like there's a repeating pattern in this book. There's these cathedrals of salt, these salt miners in Poland, outside Krakow, that when they go down and they mine salt, while they're down there in their spare time, in their lunch break, I guess, they have carved out this huge cathedral that's supposedly very beautiful. Has anyone been there, seen this? No? You have? Ah, wow, you're the first person. So it actually exists?
It was like Wow.
There was like Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper insults. Wow. But it wasn't a cathedral, but it was like a...
You went underneath? You went to it?
Yeah.
Wow. Nice.
They had a ballroom as well.
Assault ballroom. Cool. Wow. You're the first person that actually... I thought I just made it up. It's so cool. Cathedral of Salt. Beneath all this, I'm carving a cathedral of salt. I keep the entrance hidden. No one seems to notice the hours I'm missing. I'll bring you one night. It's where I go when I hang up the phone. Neither you nor your soul is waiting for me at the end of this. I know that now. The salt nearly clear after I chisel out the pews, the see-through altar, the opaque panels that depict the stations of our cross. Here's the day we met. Here's the day we remember we met. The air down here will kill us, some say. Some wear paper masks. Some still imagine the air above the green trees, thick with bees building solitary nests out of petals. What's the name for that? Ineffable? The endless white will blind you, some say. But what is there to see we haven't already seen? Some say it's like poking a stick into a river. You might as well simply write about the stick or the river. That one ends kind of suddenly, but, you know, I should have warned you. It's called My Feelings. It's a version of an erasure poem where you cross words out, but the word sort of means thinking on the page. At a certain point, there's a list of adjectives. I think they're adjectives. I'm terrible at grammar. But they're crossed out. Anyway, they're crossed out. You know, I think you'll figure out that I'm just sort of trying to find my way. My feelings. Maybe I should be locked in a cage in the center of the village, a sign the judge ordered me to carve hung around my neck to warn the children of what will happen if they feed their animals. Go ahead, use a stick, push the bowl toward me. If you come close enough, I'll tell you about the years I was faithful, how good I felt about myself, though she rarely touched me. By the end, we were simply two abandoned orphans who'd smelled each other out. These were the years I believed the body contained the soul, yet even so, I began to feel like a monster, disgusting somehow, until the shadow inside me became me. I want to say we really tried, but maybe it was simply the first moment I could be with someone and say nothing and know the other understood or close enough not to be overcome by my extravagant, subterranean, desperate, flimsy, shameful, crushing, guarded, inappropriate, dormant, backwoods, forbidden, closeted, broken, limited, insubstantial, fucked up, wounded, invisible, unspeakable, meaningless, delicate, uncontainable, elemental, filthy, shallow, feral, misguided, distant, tethered, painful, tongue-tied, wayworn, purple, all-encompassing, epic, God-given, phantom, oceanic, entitled, formal, flickering, feelings. I want to read a poem from my first book. My first book of poems is called Some Ether. And one of the great joys of that book was that it won a prize called the Larry Levis Prize that you guys gave me. And I came to Richmond then and got the prize and did a reading. And it was really an amazing thing. Larry Levis being, you know, one of my heroes and, you know, a huge influence then and still. So I wanted to read a poem from that, just to bring that book into the room. And also, this is a poem about a friend of mine that I, you know, the book came out 2001, 15 years ago. It came out like 15 years ago, but I wrote the poems like well before that. So this is about a friend that I've known for a long time, this poem. And he just died a couple days ago. They found him on the beach in Provincetown. My friend Ray Nolan. So it's called Emptying Town. It's after Provincetown, which is this, as I said, a home, one of my homes. Emptying town. Each fall, this town empties, leaving me drained, standing on the dock, waving bye-bye, the white handkerchief stuck in my throat. You know the way Jesus rips open his shirt to show us his heart, all flaming and thorny, the way he points to it. I'm afraid the way I miss you will be this obvious. I have a friend who everyone warns me is dangerous. He hides bloody images of Jesus around my house for me to find when I come home. Jesus behind the cupboard door, Jesus tucked into the mirror. He wants to save me, but we disagree from what? My version of hell is someone ripping open his shirt and saying, "Look what I did for you." And then just in that spirit, I want to read another Provincetown poem. There's another dear friend of Ray's, a friend of mine, Misha Richter, who grew up in Provincetown. And we've done these collaborations. We're working on, I sort of write a poem with him the last couple books based on his artwork. And he had this beautiful photograph of another friend of ours who, Provincetown's a very sort of shishy, arty, summer resorty place now, but it's also really dark and it has a, you know, a whole local culture there that's very different. And these people sort of represent more local culture. And Misha had taken a photograph of Paul, who this poem is about, riding his horse. He rides his horses every day bareback through the ocean. He rides them down to the ocean like early in the morning, so no one sees him except if you're up early. Fishermen and stuff see him. Harbor. This is also the last thing that Ray saw would be the harbor. Harbor. If this bowl is always empty, if it breathes, if it's lung, if a horse can rise from the ashes. Saul was a sailor on the boat to Damascus. He did not know what he was. Paul turned to a voice. It rose up from the waves. It chained his boat to the darkness. A man finds ash and he makes it a man. A horse finds ash in a horse. It lifts us, it holds us, it breaks us again. It scatters us into the harbor. I knew there were going to be some, are you molecular biologists in the back? Is that what you guys are? What kind of biologists are you? No? Biological mechanics? What are you? What do they do? But what are they? Biomedical engineers, I'm sorry. So I'm going to read this poem for you. This is for you guys. It's called A Note on the Periodic Table. The periodic table names 212 elements, or atoms, the so-called building blocks. This is like a lecture. These elements are of a different order than the elements we call fire, air, earth, or water, each of which might be referred to as archetypal. Archetypal elements are made up of a combination of atoms, except for fire, which is made only of itself, or which consumes itself in its very making. One branch of Buddhism claims space and consciousness as elements as well, as elemental as fire, air, earth, etc. 212 elements. The human bone, coincidentally, contains 212 bones, half of which are in the hands and feet. What if our purpose as human beings, assuming we have a purpose, is simply to make more of this earth, more dirt, through our shit when we breathe, and through our bodies once we stop? Would that be enough to be called a purpose? The world is about to run out of gallium, hafnium, and indium, but zinc will not disappear until 2037. Zinc is what you take to make you dream, or rather, it is used to make your dreams more vivid. Are we really using it all up? What will we do when all the zinc is gone? That's today's lesson. I want to read this one too. This is Philip Seymour Hoffman. Philip Seymour Hoffman. Last summer, I found a small box stashed away in my apartment, a box filled with enough Vicodin to kill me. I would have sworn that I'd thrown it away years earlier, but apparently not. I stared at the white pills blankly for a long while. I even took a picture of them before finally, definitely throwing them away. I'd been sober again for some years when I found that box, but every addict has one. A little box, metaphoric or actual, hidden away. Before I flushed them, I held them in my palm, marveling that at some point in the not-so-distant past, it seemed a good idea to keep a stash of pills on hand. For an emergency, I told myself. What kind of emergency? What if I needed a root canal on a Sunday night? This little box would see me through until the dentist showed up for work the next morning. Half my brain told me that, while the other half knew that looking into that box was akin to seeing a photograph of myself standing on the edge of a bridge in the familiar dark neighborhood of my mind, that comfortable place where I could somehow believe that fuck it was an adequate response to life. I'm going to read two more pieces, but one of them is a new piece. I'm reading mostly from this book, and I'm going to read a new piece, which is maybe a poem or maybe a prose piece. I'm not really sure. But this is the last poem I'll read. This is called The Incomprehensibility. The Incomprehensibility. And it has a reference at the beginning to a film by Iñárritu, the guy that made Birdman last year. But this is his earlier film called Beautiful, which I actually like more. So there's a reference to that. And then there's also a reference to James Tate, who was my first poetry teacher, and his great poem, The Lost Pilot. The Incomprehensibility. The newly dead hung onto the ceiling last night like moths, wanting to tell us what they hadn't found words for yet, their bodies still warm on their mattresses below. They did not look comfortable passing themselves on the way out. Only mystery allows us to live. Lorca wrote this on the back of one of his many drawings of a sailor, or of many sailors. Only mystery, and yet or so, I pull myself back again to a place wherein I can comprehend, if only a glimmer, the moment my mother will press a bullet into the chamber of her 38. Think of Fra Angelico's Annunciation. Nothing has happened, not yet. Mary's back is to the angel. His hand hovers over her shoulder, not touching her, not yet. It's still not too late to turn back. A Sunday morning, we can hear the ocean. We can smell it. If we could get up, we could even see it. Junkies can go to a clinic in downtown Vancouver now to shoot up in safety. We can help them find the vein, the pretty nurse says, but we cannot depress the plunger. As I write this, a Boeing 777, along with all 239 souls on board, vanishes from the sky. No distress call, no black box, no wreckage. By the time you read this, we'll all know what happened, I thought. Wormhole? Drunk pilot? But right now, it is simply gone. Let's look again at the Annunciation. Let's think of the angel as a pretty nurse. Let's think of her wings as possibility, her silence as a syringe. Let's put my mother in that airplane now. Let's let her circle forever. Let's imagine she too is unable to land. She glances out the window, sometimes at the tops of the clouds, sometimes at someone's sad house below. I know you're still in there, she whispers, raising one finger. Poke a hole through the heavy curtains, she mouths. You'll see. They're not even real. And I'm going to finish with this. Yeah, it's a little longer. This is the newest piece I've written. It's called The Room When No One Is In It. And I got the title from an artist who I don't know, but I saw his work. I saw the painting, and this was the title of the painting, The Room When No One Is In It. There's a couple fairy tales in here, and I took a sort of modified version of a fairy tale from Mary Gaitskill's book, Veronica. And then the other fairy tale is from the musician Charles Manson. There but for the matchsticks hidden in my pocket. There but for the one held in my fist. There but for the tip, white atop red. There but for my fingernail as it snaps it to life. There but for the woods spread out behind grandma's. There but for the field surrounded by stones. There but for the grass dry now as straw. There but for the path no grass grew upon it. There but for want, each match would stay whole. There but for desire, each flame would stay silent, and the red stay red, and the white stay white. There but the name, strike anywhere. There but for the name. There but for the field surrounded by woods. There but for their house hidden in trees. There but for their eyes, each turned inward. There but for their television, as blue as the war. There but for the bodies pouring into their rooms, our bodies pouring into their rooms. There but for my sneakers, there but for my shorts, there but for the grass, high now as me. There but for the match I dropped with each step, there but for the one that caught as it landed, there but for the tinder, not hard to find, a field is nothing but tinder. There but for the sound of it popping to life, there but for the stones that held the flames in, there but for me turning to look at the sound of it popping. There but for grandma on the other side of the flames, in the house I'd stay in the nights my mom worked. Grandma in her chair as her stories unfold each afternoon until time for her drink. As the world turns, one life to live. I remember my chair across from her chair, trying to focus on the story, but there was no real story, at least not one that would ever, could ever end. One night that summer, our house caught fire. Not my grandmother's house, but our house. I remember waking up to my smoke-filled room. I remember being woken up by my mother, my room now thick with smoke. I remember tumbling down the stairs into the thicker smoke. I remember my body, how it knew not to breathe. Raccoons, the story went, had knocked over our hibachi. This was the story because it was a story that had an end, even if it ended in flames. After the fire, my mother's boyfriend renovated the house, so the insurance money went to him, some of it at least. Lovers, it was hard to hand over the receipts. Married, it was hard to ask for much. Most of his time went into renovating her bedroom, as if this was the only room that mattered. Dark purple carpet, light purple walls, purple pillows, purple sheets. The rest of the house remained gray and brown, but behind her door was now a purple glow. The one window with its gauzy curtain, the one lamp with its purple shade. The tin can on her dresser that once held coffee, now filled with her tip change. Purple quarters in the purple light. The room smelled of purple chemicals, the wall-to-wall off-gassing. After he went back to his wife, she'd lock herself inside this room with her migraines. Purple became the color of pain. Purple pain. Years later, I found this boyfriend living in Florida. I don't know what you're looking for, he said, but I do know this. Each day was a question for her. Each day she'd will herself to wake up. Each night she'd will herself to go home. I imagine this is why you're here, but I imagine you already knew this. This is what you don't know. She was the one who chose purple. She spread her legs and said, "This is the color I want." I promised to move there forever with her, but in the end, I had to go home. In the end, we all have to go home. One night I saw her in the driveway, the car dark except for the glow of her cigarette, but even that was intermittent. It came and went with each breath. I knew she was always on her way elsewhere. She'd come back after midnight, and sometimes she didn't come back at all. He didn't have to tell me. Other boyfriends I tracked down told me that my brother and I were the most important thing in her life, but not this boyfriend. I remember rubbing her feet after he went back to his wife. I remember when she came home from work with a run in her stocking, how we'd race it all the way up her thigh. I remember finding a book down by the brook, how it said a woman's nipple was as delicate as a grape. I remember it said that, in fact, you should practice on a grape, rolling it around in your mouth, pressing your teeth into it, careful not to break the skin. I remember a bowl of purple grapes just out from under the faucet on my grandmother's counter. I remember the way the sun coming through the window over the sink made little windows on each drop, on each grape. I remember taking one grape into my mouth and letting it sit there for a while. I remember rolling it around in my mouth to see how long I could hold it. I remember putting the lit end of a flashlight into my mouth until my skull glowed. I remember the tip of her cigarette, the orange glow. This is the before, the moment before the kiss, his arm around her like a wing pulling her in. Kiss is a word passed from mouth to mouth, yet it cannot be heard. It is made of air and spit, and it lingers, and the skin turns cold wherever it touches down. This is the question. Would the man she was talking to and smoking with in the car come inside, or was he already inside? This is the question. In the dark car, does she cross her ankles to close herself off? And if so, do her feet look impossibly small beneath her, a child's feet, a doll's feet, all in shadow, as if a shadow could hold her up? But look, she does not look worried, but maybe that's just her face. Or maybe she really isn't worried. She is young after all. Maybe she really is in no way outside of what is happening. Maybe she really is open to whatever comes. Maybe she is just a girl who can't say no. Maybe I'm in a terrible fix. I remember walking through that dry field, lighting matches and letting them drop. I remember flicking the tip of each match with my fingernail, strike anywhere. I'd flick it on a rock, on my fly, on my teeth. I remember how the flame would at times start inside my mouth and how the smell of sulfur would fill me. Flames that sounded of wings, a match that tasted of Satan. Now wings are hidden beneath every pretty girl's t-shirt, wings tattooed on her shoulder blades. I knew an angel once. Every night I'd tell her, "Fuck me like an angel." She'd answer, "Please, please, please." An anchor was tattooed on her ankle to help her stay put. She didn't have wings. That wasn't what she needed. Wings are what we look for when we want to be elsewhere. Wings are a way out of our lives, even as we watch the roots pulling us down. Here's a fairy tale she told me. A little girl convinces herself that she could disappear and slip into the cracks of the floorboards while standing right in front of you. Her size proved helpful when vanishing. But when the little girl came to a muddy bog, rather than ruin her shoes, she threw down a loaf of bread and stepped on it. It sank into the bog, and she sank with it. She sank into a world of demons and deformed creatures. Because she was beautiful, the demon queen made her into a statue as a gift for her great-grandson. As a statue, the girl was covered in snakes. Here's the fairy tale I told her. In the desert is a hole, and when we enter this hole, we will find a city waiting for us. It has been waiting for us underground for hundreds of years, waiting for us to find it. When we go down into it, we will leave winter above. The world we leave above will all be winter. These fairy tales, this chain of words, it connected us, little flame to little flame. I remember my grandmother in the hospital and dying, how she pointed to a painting on the wall, lamenting that she couldn't change the channel. The painting was of a snow-covered house in the woods, smoke curling from the chimney. A needle rising up from her bony arm put a tiny hole in the envelope that was her and filled it with white. There, but for the purple curtains gauzy across the window, there, but for my mother still motionless in her bed. She got in late from work last night, don't wake her. Her wings never unfurled even as we fell. Her wings never unfurled even as she fell. There, but for the way the flames flared up, then died, jumping from tuft to tuft, thick with a language I didn't understand. There, but for the sun which made us all, there, but for knowing it would never stop, that the flames would jump the stones, that the woods would burn, that the houses would fall. There, but for the voice tiny inside, there, but for those words, I wouldn't have stood inside the flames and begun my stompy dance. That's it. Thanks.
Okay, now I ask you questions. In the third poem, or maybe you ask me questions. Does anyone have any questions or comments? Or anyone need water?
Nick, you work in both creative nonfiction and in poetry, and I wondered if you know when you're starting into it, which one it's going to be, which things are going to be, and do you have a different bodily feeling or psychological feeling, mental feeling, as you're writing one or the other?
I don't think I do know. I don't really know. I write in notebooks. Like, what I write doesn't look like poems. It looks more like prose almost always. And then I sort of take lines out and form them. And occasionally something comes out that's already, line breaks are already clear to me. But usually I play with a lot of different possibilities for how they're going to look, you know, for each poem. And that last piece I read, I have no idea what it is, whether it's a poem or a prose piece. I mean, it's long, so I guess, you know, and it doesn't have line breaks, but it's sort of has the movement of a poem, so I don't know what it is, really. I don't worry about that too much. If you call it prose, you'll probably get paid more, you know? But, you know, you get paid a little more, but they catch on to you pretty quickly if it's really poetry. You know, trying to pass as prose. Yeah. I don't know how... usually after a little while, something, like, if something starts to take shape, it sort of becomes clear that it's... It has to go one way or the other, you know, and usually like a longer project with connecting parts or something, it becomes prose in some way. Like if there's an argument in it, maybe, or if there's, usually I don't have many like arguments in my poetry, really. It's not really, that's not the place that I argue. I feel like I'm talking to myself. Sorry. Yeah. Other comments or questions? Yes.
I have a question.
Sure.
So this will probably strike you as very bizarre, but so the poem you did, The Periodic Table, I'm just curious, did you look at a periodic table when you wrote that poem, or?
As much as I went to Monticello. Is it not 212 elements?
No, it's not.
Oh, shit.
When you wrote it, perhaps there were 112 elements, and since then there have been two more added.
Only 112?
Yeah, there are 112. 112 is Capernaum, and then wow. There are two more. But I was just curious because, well, it's off by 50%, but I was wondering.
It's deeply unstable, yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought we were losing elements. We're finding elements? I thought we were losing elements. What about that part where I say we're losing elements? Is that a lie? Is that a lie? We have plenty of hafnium?
Hafnium's a great element.
But are we losing it? I hear we're running out of it.
No.
Did I make that up?
Hafnium actually is stable. So.
What about zinc by 2037?
Zinc is on all our coins because it's so cheap, actually.
So we're not running out of zinc?
No, but there are others that are very rare.
God, that poem has no truth in it whatsoever. Well, that's why it's a poem and not nonfiction.
I happen to be a physicist, and I happen to have memorized the periodic table because it was fun. But I was wondering where you got 212 from, if you just thought of it, or if you actually...
Is that how many bones are in the human body?
You added six.
Yeah.
I've never actually read that poem. It's totally wrong. That poem's totally wrong. You'd think someone would have Googled it, like at the press or something, right? Like, that would have been a really easy fact check thing.
I guess I was curious if anyone ever brought that up with you.
No one has. No one pointed out. Like, I thought I was convinced. Wow, I convinced myself.
I remember your name now in the periodic table, and it'll be etched in my mind forever that I think it's very cool you wrote a poem about it.
Wow, I should be embarrassed. No, but I'm not. I thought it was so beautiful that there was the same number of elements as there were bones in the body.
Oh.
That wasn't a question at all, was it?
I was just curious if you'd seen it or looked at it or if the number had some other meaning I didn't know about. But I like the number 212.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. Apparently. Huh. Wow. I guess you can get away with a lot if you do put science stuff in poems. What about the what about that thing about the crystal, that the oceans form from a crystal at the center of the Earth?
Well, crystals are solids, but they're very special solids.
Yeah, I swear I read a lot of science stuff, and maybe I don't read it that closely. Like, I swear I got these from the zinc disappearing. I got from reading a science article.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I encourage all my students to read science stuff, but not to read very closely, though. I only read the good part. I only try to read the good parts in the science articles, which I always say is the second to last paragraph. Like in the Science Times, they put like this sort of weird little fact in, and so that's all I read is the penultimate paragraph.
Well, just a little zinc story. It's inside our pennies because it's cheaper than copper. So zinc is very wonderful. It doesn't rust.
Wow. And does it make you dream?
Oh.
Oh. Wow. Oh. Wow. That's a. I heard. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. I don't know what to say about that.
I think any advertising booth is great.
Other problems people saw in the poems. any falsehoods or. Misrepresentations of the universe, of the truth of the world. I could have read my nonfiction. My nonfiction's more stable. It is.
It
is.
It's no longer half law.
Yeah. The half fiction is much more stable than nonfiction. Yes?
So I was wondering, you said you wrote some poems because they asked you to read and collaborate, but what on like a daily basis inspires you?
Yeah. There's a poet named Mary Jo Bang who came to Houston a couple of years ago, and she said this thing that what inspired her to write, I think answering this question was joy, that it brought her joy. And when she said it, I was sort of like, huh, what a concept. And I realized that I do actually, it does bring me a lot of joy, but I always thought that it needed to be about suffering and struggle and like sort of like gnashing my teeth and stuff. And now it is much more about just sort of finding sort of joy, really, in whatever, like in grammar and in syntax and in just putting words together and, you know, creating a world. And I do find that very pleasurable. And I think I always did, but somehow I thought that wasn't, I tried to ignore that because I thought that was not a suitable goal for writing poetry. It had to be something more about, you know, revealing some deep, painful inner truth. But I'm aiming for joy now. But how I do that, it's all different. And there are a lot of poems in the last two books. So, you know, I have four books of poetry, and more and more they are collaborative. They're somehow like in response to, you know, I know a lot of artists, and we end up just doing fun things together. And a poem comes out of it. And I find that to be really fun now, like to do that. Like I find that process to bring me joy. And so there's a bit of that. And there's even a couple of occasional poems in this, which are, I always said I could never write an occasional poem about something that happens at that moment, and then you write a poem that day or something. So there's a wedding poem, an Epithymalion in here, a wedding poem. You know, a dear friend of mine got married, and he asked me to write a poem, and I, you know, so I wrote this poem for his wedding. It's a really bad Epithymalion. Well, I mean, it's sort of a curse more than a blessing. You know, it's supposed to be a wedding poem. You know, it starts, the first line is, you know, this is what I read in front of the whole gathered family. No one, not the wind in the leaves, not the leaves in the sky, can promise permanence. So that was the first line of the blessing. So there's a lot of that. I wrote a poem for the marathon bombing in Boston, just because I'm from Boston, and somebody asked me, a magazine asked writers to respond to it. And there was something about that. There's something about the immediacy of writing something like that that is sort of new to me. A lot of my poems sort of took longer. Like I could spend years on a poem. There's also a poem in this book that I worked on for 20 years that I just could never get right. And I still am not convinced it's right, but it's now it's in the book. it's a periodic table. I just knew there was something wrong with it. it's called The Washing of the Body. And it's a poem that, you know, friends, me and two friends, actually the writer Michael Cunningham and I, before he was Michael Cunningham, and another poet, Michael Klein, were at a death watch for a friend at a hospital. And our other friend, Marie Howe, we went down to eat. The guys went down to eat. The woman stayed up, and then our friend died. And then we all, when we came back, she said, well, I told the nurse that you guys would wash the body. And we just, suddenly, she just put us in the room with our dead friend, and we washed the body. We washed his body. And it was something we've all written about, because it was such a profound moment. Like, Michael and Cunningham and Michael Klein have written about it, Marie Howe wrote about it. And I was just the last one. I just tried for 20 years to write this poem. And it just never felt right to me. So now it's done. Not in the poem, in the book. It seemed to fit in with the other poems enough. You know, some poems aren't perfect. You know, so that one, if you buy the book, I'll give you $1 back or something. Oh, $2 if you're a scientist. You can get it for $12 or something instead of $14. And you, sir, in the back, you had a question.
Yeah, I just want to know when getting married and the loved one, like a moment in your life that you decided that writing became a necessity in your life.
There was no like, it was sort of like there was no moment when it wasn't. I don't know why, but even as like a kid, I just was interested in language, like in moving language around, and it was also collaborative. It always seemed like a collaborative thing to do to me. Like when I was 11, I convinced a friend of mine that the best way to spend our summer vacation was to write like a long Sherlock Holmes type mystery. And we did that. We wrote 50 pages of this thing. It's lost, unfortunately. But, you know, we wrote 50 pages of this thing. And then a few years later, me and another friend, you know, because I was reading Sherlock Holmes then, and then a few years later, I was reading Kurt Vonnegut. So me and another friend wrote like a 50-page science fiction thing together. And it just seemed like fun to me. It just seemed like really fun and sort of a really, I don't know, it helped me understand the world in some way, it's the material of language. So it was always just there. It was always there. And I always tried to get other people to do it. But I realized like not everyone's really interested in doing it. You know, thank God, actually. You know, like if the whole world was just, you know, like everyone was a poet and that's all we did, like there would be no world. Right? I mean, everything would be wrong, right? But, I mean, you know? I mean, it'd be a really scary world if like everyone has, yeah, everyone's a poet. Yeah. That's a, you know, in this room, like a lot of you are poets, and you know, this is kind of a nightmare. I mean, if someone just like collapsed up front here, we just no one would know what to do. Another question, yes. Do you have a Pixies t-shirt on?
Yeah.
Look at that, for Boston. That's a Boston band.
When you approach nonfiction, is there a certain like ethic or truth that you hold on to in order to create a sort of honest rendition of the story?
Yeah, I am actually more on the line, on that continuum of like, you know, fictionalizing the world or documenting the world. I'm closer to documenting the world. But that said, I you know, there's this controversy now around, you know, like John DeGatta and David Shields of just sort of justifying that the whole world is just perception. And so you can say anything, you know, it's all your imagination. It's all, you know, it's all a fiction, which I just don't believe. I just don't believe that. I think there actually are things that exist outside of my consciousness. And there's things that happen that really have nothing to do with me. But I'm here to document it in some way. And so, yeah, I just think it's really important to get that stuff right. I think it's actually beautiful. It's a beautiful pursuit to try to understand the physics of the universe. I mean, you might not understand it from that poem, but I do actually think that understanding how the world works and observing the universe reveals things that we can't know. You sort of come up against mystery in this way. And then, you know, the creative part is just my own inner perception of things and my, you know, how it affects me, which I think is also creates a tension between those two things, which I think is interesting. And so if you just take away that tension, I don't know why you're, it's taking away a lot of the pleasure of it, actually. So, yeah, I'm much more on the documenting end of things rather than the inventing. And, yeah. But there's a whole range. I mean, you can do what you want to. Oh, yes, yes.
Hi. I don't know if you'd be interested in, like, answering a question about interpretation of your poems, but in your Cathedral of Salt poem, what does the stick in the river sort of metaphor? Like, that just confused me.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good question. Let's see. Are you on a page? What page is it on? There it is, the stick of the river, yeah. Yeah, it is a strange ending, isn't it? Some say it's like poking a stick into a river. What is there to see we haven't already seen? Some say it's like poking a stick into a river. You might as well simply write about the stick or the river. So, I don't know, what do you think it means? Do you have any idea? Is it totally just, is there any?
I've got that like image of like a stick being in a river, but I don't like see what that has to do with like.
Well, it's not just a stick in a river. You might as well write about the stick. There's some say it's like poking a stick into the river. And what is it to see we haven't already seen comes before that. So
yeah.
I'm trying to figure it out with you. There's no one answer to this. I really,
yeah,
you know.
So.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, the thing about these, I, you know, even if I did have an answer, which I don't, I'm not being coy, I probably wouldn't say it, just because it, you know, the more I can sort of not, you know, ideally a poem is an experience, right? It's not like a, there's not like one answer to something, especially like at the, usually a poem, usually, every time I say usually, then you just do the opposite, but many times a poem will just ideally, and can end just as more of an opening rather than a closing, and opening into some deeper, a bigger mystery. And sometimes that's what the poem needs. It's just not to sort of be, okay, I'm going to nail it and like nail it shut. I'm going to actually open it to something sort of that's a little weird. And that's sort of, I think, the intention there. Yeah, it's a strange poem. A lot of these poems, there's this whole way I'm writing now. One of the ways I'm writing now, if they're not occasional or collaborative, is really taking like a whole body of work and cutting it into pieces and taping it on pages and then sort of writing between them, trying to connect them. A lot of it is just finding like lines that I really like and putting them next to each other and trusting my subconscious is making some sort of meaning out of it that is beyond my understanding. And if it sounds good, if it looks good, sometimes that's good enough. That's probably a very unsatisfying answer.
No,
yeah, but you know, I do it a lot and 9 out of 10 of them don't work. And then if one works, if it works, and I'm just like, it works, but I don't really know why, it's a little mysterious, I don't really want to mess with it. I'm just like, okay, let's just leave it like that. Even if it is, to me, I don't know what it means, really.
I mean, some a philosopher probably know, you know. Some say it's like poking a stick into a river. That's an action, right? Poking a stick into a river. You might as well simply write about the stick. You break it into parts and write about the individual things. Oh. Could be that. But, oh, yeah. Okay, last one. Let's do this question. Yeah.
First, I've never read your work. Somebody told me about you and they're like, you're super cool, so I came to check it out.
How'd that work out?
I've had a good time so far. The stick in the river thing, to me, that I think that was the lines that gave me the most since I've been here, because I understood it as the vastness or the depth of a river as something that you can't understand. And the stick is in your hand. That's something that you know. That's something you can pick up and look at. That's what you should write about. And that's something I've been really thinking about a lot lately, is about writing about.
That's exactly.
Writing about what I know and not what I think I know around me. I really appreciated that line. And I also, my question was, for the person who hasn't read your work or is the first time, which book, I'm sure you have many, which book should I think about getting?
Well, I don't know. But I want you to come to all my readings, though. I'll pay you to come to my readings. Yeah. Why didn't you do that with the periodic table one? yeah, I don't know. I would just like go over the books, like, you know, go over the table and put your hand over them. And if one jumps in your hand, get that one. You know? That is how I edit poems, actually, now. I actually just, like, lay them out, like, all my drafts out, and I sort of just look at them, and the good stuff floats up to the surface. You know? Yeah. Again, it's tough to teach, but... Yeah. All right, that seems good, huh? That's good. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, we can, yeah.